By now. I strained to see around benches and slatted chairs that had been bolted to the ground. It was hard to make out anything more than silhouettes in the cloud-covered night. The dim lanterns lining the promenade were either turned off or didn't extend this far. I swallowed my fear down. No one was out hunting me. "Thomas," I whispered, inching toward the prow. On this part of the ship, the wind was merciless. I tucked my chin to my chest, though that hardly helped. If Thomas didn't appear soon, I'd... He strode toward me, a silhouette in human form. My heart raced. Was the dramatic meeting place truly necessary, Cresswell? He stopped a few feet from where I stood, shuddering. I all but rolled my eyes as he scanned me and then our surroundings. He did not move any closer, and my annoyance reared up. This was not the warm greeting I'd pictured as I sneaked about the frigid ship. Well, I'm about to catch my death. What was so urgent that we needed to meet out here at this hour? Do you have any news on Miss Prescott? He tilted his head to one side, considering. And that's when I noticed the slight reflection, as light caught on his face. As if part of his features were covered in... I gasped.
Apologies for any disappointment, miss, but my name is not Cresswell.
Mephistopheles took a hesitant step closer.
Though I am intrigued a young lady of your standing would agree to such an unchaperoned meeting.
I held the scalpel up, cursing my hands for shaking. I did not want him to think my trembling was entirely due to how frightened I was. What do you want? I managed to get out. I swore the wind bent to his will. It growled and hissed, finding every crevice in my clothing to claw its way through. Mephistopheles came forward, his cloak whipping about behind him. I did not believe in such things, but in this moment he appeared to be the devil's heir Chief Magistrate Prescott claimed he was.
Stop, or I swear I'll sever your artery. I know precisely where to inflict the most damage, sir.
I don't know what I expected, but a surprised bark of laughter, wasn't it? He removed his own cloak, his movements unhurried, as to not startle me into slashing out.
Contrary to what you may think, I'm not in the business of watching young women die. Please.
He held the cloak toward me.
Take this. It's an Angora blend. You won't find another garment as warm or soft, I guarantee it.
I gritted my teeth against their chattering and eyed the cloak. I did not want to accept any form of help from this wicked-looking young man. He slowly grinned.
Here, I'll lay it over this chair, and you can fetch it yourself.
He set it down with care, then stepped back, bowing in mockery.
Your cloak awaits, fair lady.
What do you want?
I repeated, holding my weapon at the ready. He simply crossed his arms and stared pointedly at the garment. I exhaled loudly, then snatched up the cloak. I resisted the urge to rub my cheek along the downy softness. In a matter of moments, warmth bloomed over my body, and my trembling decreased. He smirked, and I brandished my weapon once more, wiping the smug look from his face.
Answer my question, or I shall leave.
He unfolded the nearest chair and sat, crossing one leg over the other. If he was cold, sitting there in his scarlet evening jacket, as the wind howled its displeasure, it didn't show. Perhaps he wasn't entirely human. That at least would explain his seemingly inexplicable talent for magic tricks. For the first time I noticed his gloves. Each one had a crescent moon stitched onto the back of it, with stars across the knuckles. They were exquisite.
I've a proposition for you.
I started shaking my head, but he held up a hand.
It's a bargain that will prove most beneficial, I suspect. I saw the way you observed the unfortunate incident this evening. You were calculating and calm when others panicked. You searched for clues and details. Both are skills I am in need of.
Yes, it's quite unfortunate to find nearly a dozen knives in someone's back, I said coldly. What a tremendous talent you have, making the murder of a young woman sound no more horrendous than a simple act of misfortune, and then attempting to use it all to your benefit. You're disgusting. He eyed me from his seat.
Admonish me all you wish, but one fact remains. It is unfortunate. Would it make you feel better if I'd shed a tear?
I had the impression his inquiry was sincere, as if he'd relish nothing more than turning this into an opportunity to practice his performance skills.
I've had quite enough mischief for one evening. If you'll excuse me,
I came to offer my tutelage in exchange for your assistance. I believe, based on the curiosity you displayed during the show, that you wish to learn sleight of hand. I desire to preserve something very dear to me. You can help with that.
I have no desire to learn tricks, sir.
He offered a look that suggested I was a horrible liar.
You won't find a better teacher.
But I may find a less arrogant one.
I forced myself to breathe. It wasn't magic I desired to learn, but he was close to guessing the truth I'd rather hide.
Anyway, I'm sorry to inform you, sir, but I do not believe in such nonsense as magic. I am a scientist. Do not insult me with your cheap theatrics. If your charlatan's fortune-telling practices worked, then you'd have known not to bother.
Cheap theatrics?
He jumped from his chair and took a few steps in my direction. I held my ground, watching, as he slowly reached out, then pulled a card, seemingly from the air around us.
Magic is science. It's simply a fancier term for showing people the impossible is attainable.
I stared at the card, heart thumping, as he rolled it across his knuckles. It was hard to tell in the dim light, but it appeared similar to the unique playing card stuck to Miss Prescott's body. I longed to raise my scalpel again, but didn't want to alert him to my shift in mood. Either Mephistopheles was the person responsible for Miss Prescott's death, or someone with access to his cards was. Since he'd been on stage, I knew the latter to be the most probable. He watched me closely. Without the distance of the stage between us, I could easily see the intelligent gleam.
Do you deny the allure of sleight of hand, too? Are you only interested in one form of science, or would you care to expand your knowledge?
Weren't you the one who warned against accepting midnight bargains with your lot? Contrary to what you may think, I said, spitting his earlier words back at him, I'm not in the business of being a fool. Now, if you'll excuse me, it's late, and this was a waste of our time. Good night, sir.
I brushed past him, not bothering to look back as he called out,
Our bargain remains yours to take. I have a feeling you'll think of it differently soon enough. After all, murder is just another form of sleight of hand, is it not?
I hoped he hadn't noticed my steps falter as I hurried along the dark promenade, ignoring the chills that raced along my spine. Murder was another form of sleight of hand, and if the person responsible was talented enough, they might just get away with it.
4. A Tangled Web. Prescott's Quarters, RMS Etruria, 2 January, 1889.
I fiddled with the pearl buttons on my gloves as Uncle wrapped his fist against the Chief Magistrate's door. Mumbled voices rose on the other side, though they didn't stop arguing. Uncle waited a few moments before repeating the motion. He'd been up earlier than I was and had completed Miss Prescott's post-mortem on his own, leaving me too much time to think over the last 24 hours without any distractions. I stared blankly at the bolts surrounding the door. I'd barely slept the night before, tossing and turning until I thought I'd go mad. Aside from Mephistopheles' strange midnight bargain and Miss Prescott's murder, there was the constant weight of worry over Liza. I wanted to beg Captain Norwood to turn this ship around and sail straight back to England. Instead, I had to settle for taking one wretched day at a time. Patience was a loathsome virtue.
Have you heard anything I've said?
Thomas waved a hand in front of my face. One corner of his mouth quirked up.
It's truly fascinating when you do that.
Do what? Think? I batted his hand away. Pardon me.
No need.
He grinned.
You know I don't mind when you daydream about me.
Uncle glanced over his shoulder.
Might the two of you act properly for 5 minutes?
I've done nothing. I tossed my hands up. The only thing I'm guilty of is thinking about last night's murder. Mrs. Harvey said something about cartomancy. It might be worth investigating.
Uncle muttered something that sounded quite rude, and knocked once more.
Thomas stepped into my line of view and mouthed, "And guilty of picturing me without clothing?"
Before I could offer Thomas an unladylike hand gesture, the door swung open. In an instant, the teasing smile was gone from my friend's face, replaced by the cold calculation that always entered his features when observing people. I'd expected to see Chief Magistrate Prescott, but a shorter, rounder man with a receding hairline greeted us.
"Good day, gentlemen," he said, not sounding at all as if he meant it. "And, young lady, what may I assist you with?"
"I'm Dr. Jonathan Wadsworth of London, and these are my apprentices, Mr. Thomas Cresswell and Miss Audrey Rose Wadsworth. We've come to call on Mr. Prescott," Uncle said. "There are a few questions we need answered regarding the days leading up to his daughter's murder. It won't take but a few minutes of his time."
The stout man pulled his shoulders back and tried looking down his stub nose, though Uncle was a good bit taller.
"I'm afraid that's not possible at present. I've administered a tonic to quell his nerves."
He stuck his meaty hand out.
"I'm Dr. Philip Arden."
Thomas and I exchanged raised brows. Gentlemen weren't normally given elixirs for nerves, a foolish societal notion claiming men didn't experience such emotions. But I was more concerned with the blatant lie. We'd just heard the two men arguing through the closed door. Uncle nodded.
"Any information Mr. Prescott may offer will do, even in his current condition."
"I'm afraid I must insist you come back another time,"
Dr. Arden said, slowly closing the door in our faces.
"The Prescotts desire time to process the sudden death of their only daughter. Surely you understand the need for such delicacy?"
I bit down on my tongue. Part of me wanted to say I didn't understand at all, to talk sternly about the importance of ferreting out any clues before they were lost to memory. However, I knew that was a harsh viewpoint given the circumstances. Their only daughter died brutally in front of them. If they needed time to mourn, it was the least we could offer. A door creaked open down the corridor, yet no one stepped out. I caught Thomas's eye and jerked my head in the direction. He took a small step toward the room and paused, nodding in assent. Someone was eavesdropping. I tuned back into the conversation between Dr. Arden and my uncle, hoping they'd hurry it along.
"Very well," Uncle relented. "Please let him know I stopped by. I'll return again later this evening."
I dropped a polite curtsy, but before Dr. Arden could tip his hat, I was moving swiftly down the corridor. I was about to raise my fist and knock when I noticed Mrs. Prescott staring blankly ahead, eyes rimmed in the red of the grief-stricken.
"Mrs. Prescott,"
I moved slowly into her line of vision.
"Do you need me to fetch? I told him we shouldn't accept the offer," she said, eyes fixed on the ocean. "It was his pride that doomed her."
I felt Uncle and Thomas hovering behind me and held a hand to stall them.
"What offer made you uncomfortable? Was it something you received prior to boarding the ship?"
She blinked at me, as if realizing she wasn't speaking into the void after all.
"A letter. We'd received an invitation, as did the Ardens."
She laughed, the sound anything but amused.
"Esteemed guest, indeed. Robert enjoys believing his own press, that his opinion is one to aspire to attain. There wasn't any way he'd miss an opportunity to show off. Vanity is a sin."
"Does Mr. Prescott know who sent the letter?" I pressed. "May I see it?" A tear slipped down her cheek, then another. She turned her attention on me, and her emotions punched me in my very core.
"What good will it do? My Olivia is gone."
Thomas shifted, fingers tapping his sides. He reminded me of a hound who'd scented a promising lead and wanted to hunt it down no matter the cost. I made to grab him, but he carefully sidestepped my reach.
"Mrs. Prescott, if I may offer my opinion," he asked.
I closed my eyes. Thomas was many incredible things, but subtle he was not.
"You have suffered a tragedy most could neither imagine nor endure.
Yet here you stand, breathing, living, which is the most difficult thing to do. People often admire physical strength, but I believe it's the simple things one does after a tragedy that defines them. There is no greater show of power than continuing to live when you'd like nothing more than to lie down and let the world fade. Your strength and conviction are needed now to assist us in capturing whoever did this to your daughter. Miss Olivia might be gone, but what you do next will help her seek the justice she deserves.
I blinked back the stinging in my eyes, completely and utterly speechless. Mrs. Prescott seemed equally dazed, but recovered swiftly and disappeared into her room. I stood there, mouth agape, not knowing who this Thomas Cresswell was.
He flashed a quick grin. A lifetime full of surprises, remember, Wadsworth?
Indeed. I could not imagine a future that didn't include unwinding each secret he possessed. Mrs. Prescott finally made her way back to where we lingered in the doorway. Here, she said, sniffling. For Olivia. Thomas took the letter with great care, holding it to his chest.
We will find who did this, Mrs. Prescott, and they will be made to pay.
I glanced sharply in Thomas's direction. His tone sent a creeping chill across my skin. I did not doubt that he would fight with everything he had to solve this case. Mrs. Prescott swallowed hard. If you'll excuse me, I need to lie down again. We bid her goodbye and continued down the promenade. Uncle glanced over at us while we walked, expression shuttered. I wondered if he was thinking about Aunt Amelia, worried that she might be in an equally horrid condition, going mad with panic over Liza's disappearance. So often we were only tasked with cutting open the dead, searching the aftermath for clues. Speaking with the living during their time of grief was much harder. It was nearly impossible to turn emotions off and disconnect from the gruesome work that needed to be done. Once we were far enough down the promenade deck, Thomas stopped and handed the invitation to me. It was quite decadent as far as envelopes went. The paper was a shiny ink blue, and the letters were a swirling silver and gold. Little stars littered the border as if someone had blown glitter across the page. It reminded me immediately of the Moonlight Carnival. I traced my finger over the glossy finish and opened the letter up. The Moonlight Carnival. Dear esteemed guest, you and your family have been cordially invited to experience 7 nights of magic, mischief, and mayhem aboard the RMS Etruria free of charge. Indulge in the Moonlight Carnival, the only show where performances are based on tarot cards and the Wheel of Fortune determines your fate. We'd like to extend one simple warning before setting sail. Beware of midnight bargains. If you're not careful, you might lose your life, your very soul, to this magical traveling show. Should you enjoy this spectacular voyage, please consider putting in a good word at your gentleman's club. Your endorsement is much desired. Sincerely, your secret benefactor.
What do either of you make of this? Uncle asked. First impressions.
It's hard to say. I drew in a deep breath, my mind turning over the words. On one hand, I understand Mrs. Prescott's distrust. Why seek endorsement from a judge? Surely there are more influential members of the aristocracy to target for that sort of thing? I scanned the letter again, then handed it to Thomas. I'd claim it was highly unlikely to have been sent by anyone associated with the carnival. Which of them could afford to purchase passage for 4 first-class passengers?
But, Thomas urged, brow raised. I had the impression he'd come to the same conclusion and was giving me an opportunity to shine.
It's very close to the opening statement Mephistopheles made. I pointed to the one line that was practically identical. You might lose your life, your very soul, to this magical traveling show. Who else would be privy to that speech, if not a carnival worker?
Uncle twisted his moustache, focus turned inward. Perhaps someone who's attended the carnival before. This isn't the first time the Moonlight Carnival is performing.
True,
I said, unconvinced. It still doesn't explain why they'd wish to frame the circus. Thus far, there are no witnesses that we know of, no motive as to why Miss Prescott was targeted, and no decent reason to orchestrate such a tangled web to commit one murder. Why not simply wait until the lights are out, strike, then slip back to wherever they emerged from? Thomas paced the deck, his movements quick and precise, much like I imagined his thoughts to be. He stopped abruptly and moved to the railing, staring out at the endless sea. Uncle and I glanced at each other, but didn't dare interrupt him while he traveled into that dark, twisted part of himself. A few moments later, he half turned, shoulders stiff.
The murderer is likely someone who enjoys the spectacle. He isn't interested in quietly committing his dark deeds. He wants drama, the thrill of seeing people recoil.
The wind blew a section of hair across his brow. He turned to us, expression hard.
Next time, the victim will be revealed in a grander fashion, one that cannot simply be thought of as a performance. Wherever he is right now, he's seething, enraged that more people weren't afraid of his opening act. When he strikes again, every passenger aboard this ship will be imprisoned by their fear. I guarantee he means to turn this cruise into a fantastical nightmare.
After a prolonged pause, Uncle motioned for us to be on our way.
Be on guard at all times, both of you. The last thing we need is any more trouble for this family.
While dressing for the evening show, I replayed Thomas's dire proclamation in my mind. By the time the attendant finished pinning the last rosebud in my hair, my stomach was completely knotted. If Thomas was correct, and I had no doubt he was, then another person was about to die. Uncle had warned us to be on guard, so I'd taken his advice rather literally. In my silk off-the-shoulder gown, dyed a dark purplish black, I felt as if I were a figure that could easily blend into the shadows and observe the dining saloon if needed. I removed my mother's heart-shaped locket from the jewelry box and handed it to the attendant, immediately comforted as its weight settled on my breastbone. Once the attendant left, I carefully perched on the edge of a chair, mulling over facts. According to Mrs. Prescott, both Chief Magistrate Prescott and Dr. Arden received invitations to experience the Moonlight Carnival, all expenses anonymously paid. They knew each other outside of the Etruria, but I needed to investigate their relationship further, which might prove difficult, as Dr. Arden had the welcoming personality of a slug. He'd actually taken to staying in Mr. Prescott's chamber and refused to speak with anyone for at least another day or two. Letting that lead go for the time being, I focused on what I already knew. Miss Prescott was slain as soon as the lights went out, a coincidence perhaps, but I didn't believe so. Someone who knew precisely when it would be dark in the dining saloon had waited to strike. Another indication that whoever committed the heinous act was somehow involved with the carnival, or someone who might have observed any rehearsals. I made a mental notation to speak with the captain again. He'd have names of crew members on duty. Then there was the matter of the Ace of Clubs. Its connection was still unclear, although that might be the point. Maybe the card was nothing more than a distraction, though cartomancy was another avenue that might prove beneficial. Someone knocked on the connecting room door, tugging me from my thoughts. I stood, smoothing down the front of my gown. Yes? I expected Mrs. Harvey, fetching me for supper. Instead, Thomas waltzed in, as if being alone with me in my bedchamber was not utterly scandalous. I scanned him from head to toe in his dress suit. Surely looking so handsome had to be a criminal offense. Where's Mrs. Harvey? I both hoped and dreaded that she would join us. Thomas slowed his pace, inspecting me as if to gauge my emotions. Whatever he saw in my expression made his lips twitch.
In the dining saloon with your uncle, waiting for us.
How did you manage?
Words failed as he strode over and gathered me into his arms. His eyes, while slightly filled with mirth, were dark and deep enough for me to drown in. Our last stolen kiss felt like it had happened ages ago,
and every nerve in my body tingled with anticipation. God save me, I wanted him. One of his hands slowly trailed down my back, and my breath hitched, igniting something in his gaze that practically undid me. Never one to disappoint, he bent his face to mine, a smile curving those wonderful lips as he tilted my chin up.
Have I swept you off your feet yet, Wadsworth?
Without replying, my mouth was on his. I hadn't yet pulled my gloves on, so my bare fingertips roamed over his skin, and he replied in kind. Each stroke consumed my senses, until all I could think of was where his hands might explore next, and the expanding hope that his lips might follow their careful path. His love was pure yet intoxicating, sweet and powerful. I'd never tire of this, of touching him and being touched by him. As if he knew exactly how he made me feel, he slid his hands over my shoulders and up into my hair, moving until our bodies pressed together. I could have sworn there was an electric current running over every place we made contact. He whispered my name while dropping kisses down my throat and along my bare collarbone, stopping right where my locket lay. A need greater than propriety overcame me. Heart pounding, I tugged his suit jacket off and maneuvered us toward my bed. Thomas gently laid me down, his body hovering above mine. It might not be medically possible, but I swore if he didn't touch me again soon, I'd combust. He ran a thumb over my bottom lip, gaze thoughtful.
I love when you look at me that way.
I searched his eyes. How?
Like you might possibly love me in the same extraordinary way that I love you.
Any tether of self-control I'd clutched at slipped from my grasp. I drew him down until his weight settled on me, marveling at how incredible it felt to share a bed with him. I traced the strong lines of his jaw, getting lost in the golden flecks of his eyes, before slowly bringing my mouth to his again. When his tongue touched mine, I nearly lost my senses. Kissing him was my favorite indulgence, and he certainly enjoyed spoiling me. Perhaps you're right. We ought to get married on the boat, I said, breathing heavily. I might be ready to do more than kiss him, especially if he kept tracing those idle circles on my bodice. With a knowing grin, he kissed me once more, then resumed his attention to my neck. His teeth grazed the sensitive skin of my throat as his hand slipped down to my hip. Saints help me. Do you think there's a priest? Father couldn't possibly be that mad if we eloped. Uncle might agree to be our witness, or Mrs. Harvey. Thomas pulled back enough to look into my eyes, his wicked grin returning.
Miss Audrey Rose Wadsworth, conqueror of my soul, you are an absolute fiend. You'd like to flout tradition simply because of your need for my body.
He held a hand over his heart.
I swear I have never loved you more.
Warmth spread to my face. You're impossible.
Impossible not to adore.
With a seemingly great amount of effort, he pushed himself up and assisted me to my feet. There was still a hunger in his eyes that matched my own, and I wondered which of us would go mad with want first. I dragged my gaze away from him and settled it back on the bed, devising a way to reverse a few moments in time.
Have I ever told you about our country estate?
I blinked at the sudden change in topic. I don't believe so. Thomas moved his hands up my wrists to my arms, then glided them down to my waist. He brought my body to his, lips ghosting over mine, and I fought to remain in control. I had the impression that if I were to kiss him again, neither one of us would regain our composure. In that moment, I wasn't sure I wanted to do the proper thing.
Once we're married, I'd like to take you there,
he whispered.
I'll send most of the staff away. We'll have all the privacy in the world, no more sneaking about. When you look at me the way you are now, my virtue is perilously close to corruption, and I've never been a very pious man, Wadsworth.
Heat pooled in my core at such a shocking declaration. I found I couldn't wait for the day we stopped holding ourselves back. You truly are a scoundrel, Thomas Cresswell. He chuckled.
Ah, yes, but that sparkle in your eye indicates you adore it. And I love nothing more than pleasing you, so I'll do my best at being the worst.
How romantic of you.
I thought so, too.
He glanced at the clock on my nightstand.
I'm afraid your uncle might murder Mrs. Harvey if we don't hurry back. He was eyeing up the knives when I left, and I don't believe he was contemplating which was the correct one to use on his fillet.
I forced my gaze away from his mouth. Thoughts of actual murder shattered any remaining heat I'd felt between us. I sighed. Let's go save our chaperones, then. Thomas shrugged his jacket on, then exited through Mrs. Harvey's room. I studied my reflection in the looking glass, adjusting dark curls that had slipped free. I touched my lips, hoping they didn't appear swollen with kisses to anyone else's eye. I couldn't wait to write to Liza. She lived for this sort of romantic detail. She'd be shocked and delighted and... I gasped as if I'd been struck a hard blow. I'd momentarily forgot she was missing. I bent over, pressing my hands to my center, and dragged in a deep breath, trying to quell my nerves. I was a terrible wanton thing, getting so distracted by Thomas's lips. I swore to do better the rest of the voyage. A moment later, he knocked on my outer door like a proper gentleman escort. I pushed my worries aside, opened the door, and accepted his arm. He was right. There wasn't anything we could do for Liza while trapped on this ship. Once we made land in America, I could orchestrate a better plan.
Ready?
Thomas asked. I nodded. We moved as swiftly as my silken shoes permitted into the inner corridor that led to the saloon. We checked our overcoats and Thomas's white silk muffler with an attendant and hurried down the hall, Thomas striding confidently in his full dress suit. I paused, gaping at a rose he wore, fastened through his dress coat's buttonhole. I hadn't noticed it before I'd taken his jacket off. Truthfully, I hadn't been thinking of much outside of our embrace. He caught my stare and winked.
They've got hothouse flowers on board for a shamefully indecent price. Clearly I thought of you while dressing. Do feel free to return the favor any time, only perhaps you ought to do it in reverse.
My clever retort died on my lips when the doors were swept open for us by two liveried attendants. The color scheme was the same black and white floors and sparkling ink-blue curtains from yesterday, but tonight there were silver and gold accents. Flowers, candelabras, and strands of beads made up centerpieces, a waterfall of excess riches. What caught my attention, and most everyone else's, judging from their wide-eyed looks, were the masked performers filing into the room, twirling silver swords as if they were batons. Light bounced around off their blades, sending a flutter into my heart. They were an army of performers, dressed for battle. Any one of them might turn their weapon on a dinner guest. Worse yet, all of them held the power to make this feast a bloodbath. My steps faltered. I couldn't imagine a spectacle that would please a hungry killer more, and hoped I was wrong. 5. Knight of Swords. Dining Saloon, RMS Etruria, 2 January, 1889.
It's all right, breathe.
Thomas guided me to our table and pulled my chair out, though there were waiters at the ready. A few of them blanched, but they did not dare step forward and remove him from the task he'd assigned himself. At Thomas's show of chivalry, Uncle Jonathan lifted his attention from his fork and knife. He stared, expression inscrutable, and Lord only knew what he thought of Thomas's careful attention to me. I doubted he could hear my heart thudding. But irrationally worried, the words, "I kissed Thomas Cresswell most wantonly," were suddenly painted above my brow. A smile started at the edges of his lips, as if he'd dissected the very thought from my head.
Audrey Rose.
He nodded as my escort took the seat beside him, across from me.
Thomas, you're just in time.
Mrs. Harvey sat on my right, across from my uncle, and gave me a nod of approval.
You look beautiful, dear. That color suits you well. Eggplant is such a marvelous shade for dreary January evenings. Hides a multitude of sins as well.
At my furrowed brow, she motioned to a slight stain on her pale dress. It appeared to be liquid in nature, though I couldn't be sure.
Thank you, Mrs. Harvey.
Before I could remark on the fashionable gown and dazzling jewels she wore, the lights dimmed. Being aboard a ship fitted with electricity was enchanting, especially when it was used to create a thrum of excitement. I glanced around the room, taking note of anyone who appeared nervous, but no one stood out. Captain Norwood hadn't announced the truth regarding Miss Prescott's death, mostly for his own good, but also because the Prescotts had asked for discretion. Diners chattered excitedly at their tables, and swordsmen and women continued swinging their blades, and all was strangely well. Maybe Thomas was wrong. Maybe tonight's show would not end in death. I picked up my goblet and sipped, releasing the last bit of tension from my spine. Smoke flitted along the bottom of the curtains, teasing yet promising a blaze just out of sight. My palms dampened my sheer gloves. It was almost time. I peeked over at Uncle, but he was preoccupied with his supper. He tore into his fillet with a singular focus he usually reserved for the dead we studied. Apparently, he didn't believe that murder was on the menu again this evening, at least not in this room.
"Esteemed passengers of the Etruria," the ringmaster crooned, appearing once again from the cover of thick smoke.
I shuddered at the memory of him appearing just as suddenly last night.
"Welcome to night two of the Moonlight Carnival. The Wheel of Fortune has chosen an extraordinary performance. For your viewing pleasure, may I present an evening of thrills, chills, and quite possibly spills of blood."
Without warning, the curtains peeled back like splayed flesh, revealing a masked young woman in a corset made of crushed red velvet and midnight stockings, and little else. Coffee and caramel hair was done up in ringlets that added inches to her height. Her bustle had layers of black crinoline edged in red ribbon that was quite beautiful. A heart was cut out between her neck and bosom, showing off her décolletage. Ties in black ribbon mimicked the back of her corset, holding the neckline together. Matching black appliques adorned each hip. She wore a filigree mask that was a metal so dark it appeared to be frozen oil. Dressed in red and black, she donned the feminine equivalent of the ringmaster's suit. There was a collective gasp as the crowd took in the masked woman and then the oversized sword gleaming in her hands. Much like her costume, the sword's hilt was a thing of beauty. Carved in nearly black metal, it resembled a bouquet of wildflowers and bird wings. It was like a fairy blade, forged in some wild heavenly fire. Behind the mask, the young woman's eyes met mine and widened. Why on earth? I covered my mouth, trying to contain my gasp as recognition shot through me like an arrow. No matter how or why, I knew one thing for certain. The girl on stage was my missing cousin, Liza. I swallowed hard, my focus never leaving hers. Even with the mask covering half her face, I knew it was her. The ringmaster moved into view, breaking the spell between us, and I set my goblet back down with a thud. Liquid splattered the tablecloth, and an attendant, ever vigilant, swiftly sopped up the mess. Liza? I barely blinked, worried she was a specter I'd conjured up and would disappear just as quickly.
"Try not to lose your hearts or your heads."
Mephistopheles' eyes gleamed.
"And lovely Liza will try to keep hers as Jian Yu, the invincible, the incredible, the superior knight of swords, saws her in half."
While the crowd roared in delight, I gulped down my growing horror.
"Well, this is an interesting development," Thomas whispered.
I stared at him, unsurprised that he was practically bouncing in his chair. He adored riddles and unexpected pieces to sort out. Tonight had just become one of the grandest puzzles of all. "If by interesting you mean absolutely horrid, then yes, I agree." Uncle inhaled sharply, and I knew he'd recognized our wayward family member as well.
I refused to look at him, knowing he must be furious. What she'd done was far worse than simply run off. Maybe not in my eyes or uncle's, but in society's, she might as well brand herself a harlot. Mephistopheles cleared his throat, spurring my cousin into action. Liza grinned seductively at the crowd and lifted the sword above her head, strutting along the stage as if she were born to do so. My pulse thundered. I was both speechless and proud.
"Your aunt would have a stroke if she were to witness Liza in such a state," Thomas said, earning a swift glare from my uncle.
He drew his brows together.
"Is it not true?"
"Thomas," uncle warned.
"Enough."
In spite of the terrible circumstances, I smiled. My cousin was living out her romantic dreams, uncaring what the world thought of her. I admired her, though a sliver of worry slipped in as I recalled Mephistopheles' fateful words. It appeared Liza had lost both her heart and her head to this carnival. Suddenly, her last letter came back to me. She'd mentioned being secretly courted by an escape artist. Gasps went up around us, and I shifted to see what had caused such a stir. A sound of ominous hoofbeats filled the room as Jian Yu, the invincible, the incredible, the Knight of Swords, rode a black horse dressed in chainmail through the saloon. The animal's liquid eyes flashed their whites, and it reared up into the air, hooves crashing onto the tile with enough force to rattle glasses. Mrs. Harvey clutched my arm, and a few women seated close enough shrieked. Jian seemed as hardened as the armor he wore. His silver mask completely covered one eye and ended in a series of points sharp enough to pierce skin on the other side. It appeared as if a crown of swords had melted and formed itself around his head. He was the living embodiment of the Knight of Swords tarot card, and his costume reflected it perfectly. In his wake, the other sword-wielding performers sheathed their weapons with a sound that sent spikes into my veins and dropped to their knees as if in supplication. Gooseflesh rose along my arms. The whole scene was terrifying, made even more so by the silence that buffered Jian. He rode the horse up the stairs, his gait unhurried. He wanted us to admire him as he went by. Long dark hair was tied back at the nape of his neck, offering the crowd a good look at his equally dark, angular features, sharp enough to slice through a few hearts, judging from the fans snapping open and the excited chatter coming from the women. Mrs. Harvey took a long pull of her ice water, and Thomas rolled his eyes.
"Is a muscular physique truly that inspiring, or is it the dangerous scar over one eye?"
he asked, though Mrs. Harvey didn't trouble herself with answering, or tearing her gaze from the young man now on stage. Jian hopped down from his steed and thrust the reins at Liza, jerking his chin toward the curtains.
"Have you been studying those journals I gave you, Audrey Rose?"
uncle interrupted, pulling my attention to him.
"I'll need both you and Thomas to be well-versed in marks made with an..."
Uncle fixed his gaze on something across the room, piquing my curiosity. A second assistant rolled a coffin-type contraption onto the stage. Holes were cut out near the top, bottom, and sides of the strange box. Lengths of rope were lassoed about each end and also looped over the shoulders of the female assistants.
"Oh, good," Thomas said blandly. "I was hoping they'd wheel the dead out before dessert. Entrails go better with the main course. Don't you agree, Wadsworth?"
He crinkled his nose.
"Totally wrong for sweets."
"Be serious," my heart raced despite my admonishment. "No one is going to spill entrails."
He cocked his head. "I am being serious. That box is used to saw people in half. One wrong move and those in the front row will have blood spatter and severed organs sloshing onto their tables. Messy business for the moose and berries. Though if we do have a murderer aboard, this might be the spectacle killing we feared."
Jian sheathed the swords he'd been swinging about and made a show of inspecting every inch of the wooden box. Liza and the second assistant stood to either side, smiling broadly as if one of them might not be cut open before our very eyes. I subtly wiped my hands down the front of my skirts. Part of me was morbidly fascinated
and the other part disgusted by that same fascination. Some days I despised the contradictions of my mind and the darkness in my heart.
You don't think Liza will be the one?
I stopped speaking, eyes fastened to Jian as he stepped up to the edge of the stage and lifted a hand to his face as if he were shielding his eyes from the sun. The dining saloon quieted a bit, but noise persisted.
A volunteer,
he grumbled, a slight accent apparent.
Now.
No one seemed inclined to offer themselves up as a potential sacrifice, and I couldn't blame them. Who in possession of their logical senses would do such a thing? Jian's mask glinted as he stalked to the opposite end of the stage. He glared at a table full of young gentlemen.
You are all cowards, not worthy of meeting my blades.
He turned to the assistants on stage.
Liza!
My cousin's smile was frozen, though her throat bobbed and her knees locked, betraying her fear. She took a deep breath and stepped forward. Before I knew what I was doing, I was out of my seat, tossing my napkin onto my half-eaten food.
Wait!
Ah!
Jian grinned, wide and toothy.
We have an assistant after all.
Even though I was standing, half ready to run across the stage and toss myself into that box of death, the knight's gaze was not directed at me. He was looking across from where I stood, knees wobbling, to where Thomas was already making his way up the stairs and onto the stage, steps sure and unhurried. The precise opposite of my heartbeat. Everything inside my body went numb and prickly at once.
Thomas, please don't!
I stared, hands clenched at my sides, as he paused before the coffin and, after winking at me over his shoulder, climbed inside.
Sit, dear, Mrs. Harvey whispered, reaching for my arm. You appear a little piqued. Have some wine. It soothes the nerves.
She signaled to a waiter, who poured a deep red blend from the carafe he held. I tried not to think of Miss Prescott's blood as it sloshed into my cup. There you are. Be a good girl and take a few sips. Without argument, I plopped back into my chair and took the proffered glass, bringing it to my lips, barely registering the sour grape taste as it slid down my throat in quick drabs. I didn't care much for wine, but it did distract me, briefly. I dabbed at the corners of my mouth with a linen napkin, attention straying to where Thomas poked his head, arms and feet out from the coffin-shaped box, then stayed perfectly still. Flashes of him lying dead on a morgue table assaulted my senses, and it took every last bit of my self-control not to rush the stage and drag him into my arms. The rational part of my brain knew with certainty that no harm would come to him. Carnivals were in the business of selling tickets and creating spectacles, not murdering patrons. Even if that was precisely what had happened last night. I could not shake the tension from my limbs as Liza and the second assistant covered the wooden box with a lid and nodded to Jian. I sat straighter, easing the boning from my center. The room suddenly felt hotter, and I wished to be outside on the deck, the icy winter air waltzing along beside me as it drifted through the covered promenade. Uncle huffed at the sight of Thomas shoved into the box, but I noticed the crease of worry that appeared between his brows. It did nothing to assuage my own fears.
Foolish boy.
I clutched my mother's heart pendant hanging around my neck, ignoring the bite of metal in my palm. Thomas removed his arm from view, then brandished a card when he stuck his hand back out. I could have sworn the massive ship encountered turbulence as I swayed in my seat. People in the crowd laughed at the ridiculousness of Thomas's disembodied arm fluttering the card about. But I couldn't tear my gaze from the enormous saw both assistants walked over to the knight. Metal teeth on the blade glinted, ready to sink into the wooden box, and Thomas's flesh, should anything not go according to plan. Or perhaps his murder was the plan. A bead of sweat rolled down my spine. All it would take was one false move and his lifeblood would spill.
There, there, dear, Mrs. Harvey patted my hand. I let my breath out and she smiled. It's only an illusion.
What happened yesterday was terrible, but the odds of murder happening a second time, well, it's simply not probable. Our Thomas knows what he's doing, hmm? I swallowed hard and nodded. I knew she was correct, but my heart didn't want to listen to reason. It quickened at the thought of all the horrible things that could happen. Thomas knew what he was doing, even if what he was doing was an awful idea. Liza shot me an unreadable look over her shoulder. I tensed all over again as Jian lifted his saw above his head. I nearly ran for one of the kneeling performers, ready to seize one of their swords should Thomas be hurt.
You can see the blade is very real. Isabella, if you would, demonstrate.
He nodded toward the second assistant. Isabella stepped forward and hacked at the saw with a sword she'd picked up from the table, the metal clanging for all to hear. I gritted my teeth at the noise. A young man at the next table covered his ears.
It is also very sharp. Liza?
My cousin flourished a filigree mask hidden on her person and set it on top of the box. Jian carefully sawed back and forth until it snapped in two. I tried not to dwell on the fact that it had only taken 3 passes for the blade to break the metal in half. It was much too sharp to be anywhere near my beloved Cresswell. I took a deep, steadying breath as Jian prowled around the box, saw lifted proudly above his head. He stopped near where Thomas's center would be, then motioned to Isabella. She picked her way across stage, grinning widely, hands planted firmly on her hips like a ballet dancer. She stood opposite the knight. Apparently the sawing bit required 2 people. I twisted the napkin in my lap as Jian fit the blade into one side of the box and pushed it over to Isabella.
On the count of 3, he ordered. 1, 2, 3.
Metal on wood screeched in a screech-scratch pattern, the blade sinking deeper and deeper into the box. 6. Sawn in half. Dining Saloon, RMS Etruria, 2 January, 1889. I wanted to cover my eyes, run from the room, and toss myself overboard, but forced my body to sit and be still. Meanwhile, on the stage, Thomas's hands and feet waved frantically as the saw got ever closer to his person. A few people turned away from the show, snapping their fans out and calling for smelling salts. Should this act fail, it would likely be the most gruesome sight anyone here would ever witness, myself included. The aftermath of death and murder was difficult business. But actually watching it happen? I shut my eyes for a moment. I did not want to imagine the darkness that would be unleashed from myself if Thomas died on that stage. Oh dear, Mrs. Harvey took a generous swig of her own wine. It's terribly lifelike, isn't it? I would swear that blade was really cutting into him. I clamped my jaw so tightly it ached. There were only a few more inches left, and the sword would go through the center portion of the box, and through Thomas. Scritch, scratch, scritch, scratch. I mentally tallied where my medical bag was, how long it would take for me to sprint to my cabin in my evening gown and retrieve it, and if I'd have the skills necessary to sew him together. I hoped there was a surgeon on board, someone more skilled than Dr. Arden, who was still sanctioned away with Chief Magistrate Prescott. Scritch, scratch. Scritch, scratch. I held my breath as the saw struck the bottom of the wood, waiting for blood and viscera to gush out beneath the crack. Thomas stopped moving. My heart might have ceased as well. Murmurs went up around me, but the voices were indistinguishable noise as I stared, waiting to see Thomas bleed out. Nothing happened. Thomas's hands and feet suddenly moved about, as if a blade hadn't sliced through his middle. I partially stood, ready to clap and have this be done. But apparently this nightmare wasn't yet over. Jian and Isabella repeated the performance with another blade. Once it soared down to the table, each of them took one side of the box and pulled it apart. I don't remember having decided to do so, but I screamed. It was loud and terrible
and enough to make Uncle drop his fork and Mrs. Harvey fumble for her wine glass. The Knight of Swords laughed, the sound dark and ominous, like a storm rolling over the sea.
A man sawn in two!
Another few people in the crowd screamed. I clapped a hand over my mouth, trying to keep any more of my own shrieks from escaping. The two wide blades covered each end of the box, obscuring any spilled viscera from the audience's view, though I logically knew there wasn't anything to hide. My emotions won against logic, and panic settled under my ribs. Thomas's hands. I focused on them, and the card he still waved about. They were moving. He was moving. This was an illusion, a terrible trick. I blinked tears back, hating Thomas for doing this. Gian wheeled the two halves of my whole heart around the stage, proudly showing off his skill with a blade. After they did a complete turn, they pushed the box back together, then removed both blades. I gripped the edge of my seat, tethering myself to it, to keep from flying up there to rip the coffin open and run my hands over Thomas. Liza brandished a black canvas sheet, large enough to conceal the box. They covered it, walked around it once more, then ripped the sheet off with a snap. They lifted the lid and... nothing. Thomas didn't emerge, and his arms and legs were no longer visible. My heart thudded dully. The sounds in the room, slowly becoming loud and silent at once. Part of me wished I'd thought of calling for smelling salts. Liza and Isabella exchanged worried glances that I didn't think were part of the act. I stood, heart hammering. Gian sheathed the swords he'd been swirling about and stalked over to the box, hands fisted. Something was wrong. As he approached, Thomas popped up like a jack-in-the-box, holding a second card, and Gian startled back. The audience cackled at the expression on the knight's face. It was as sour as if he'd been sinking his teeth into tart lemons. Without warning, he yanked a thin sword from the sheath on his back and plunged it directly through the center of the card, cutting off any more laughter. Thomas hopped out of the box, offering a quick bow before bounding down the stairs, his cheeks pleasantly flushed.
He looked rather annoyed by my performance, he said, breathing a bit hard. I thought it was a brilliant touch, a little laughter to balance out the fear.
Gian and his assistants exited the stage, but I couldn't concentrate on anything other than a bit of frayed fabric on Thomas's waistcoat. My blood felt as cold as ocean water as it surged through me.
You were cut.
Thomas brushed a piece of dampened hair back, but didn't comment. Mephistopheles re-emerged from the smoke like the devil he was. He smirked out at the passengers, then motioned behind the velvet curtains. On command, they pulled back, and Gian, Liza, and Isabella swept into deep bows and curtsies. The crowd whistled and cheered, some even took up stomping their feet again, while others removed the hothouse flowers from vases and tossed them onto the stage floor. I couldn't find the will to join them. Instead, I watched the fire flash in the knight's eyes. My friend had annoyed him, and he did not seem like the sort who enjoyed being made to look foolish. A muscle in his jaw twitched when his attention settled on Thomas. I swore there was some silent promise that passed between the two of them when Thomas noticed his scrutiny.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mephistopheles said, seems no one has lost their heads tonight, but will you be as fortunate tomorrow? We shall consult the Wheel of Fortune and see. Good night.
Each performer stepped back just as the curtains drew to a close, disappearing from sight. I turned on Thomas, hands wrapped around my goblet to avoid strangling him.
Are you quite mad? You could have been hurt.
His gaze swept from my grip on my goblet to the tension in my jaw. He held his hands up, surrendering to my anger.
Easy now, Wadsworth. Perhaps we ought to move away from the cutlery and glass. I assure you I was perfectly safe.
I snorted.
Of course you were. Who wouldn't be perfectly safe while being sawn in two? Especially after someone was murdered yesterday. How very foolish of me to worry.
Audrey Rose, Uncle warned, please control yourself until after dinner.
I have enough to contend with after Liza's performance.
He stood, tossing his napkin down.
In fact, I'm going to fetch her now. She'll be joining you in your